sitting here thinking what I should talk about. Yeah, waiting for major inspiration to come down. Something to...
About your age.
They say I'm 50 today. Feels just like yesterday. Aspects of say reflecting on Buddhist teachings is it's like you're trying to pay attention to two realities. There's a conventional reality and a transcendent reality, and conventional reality is that I'm 50 years old, born July 26, 1949, and you rely on the physical elements, physical body, which is subject to aging, sickness, death, and has a beginning and an end, is fraught with the uncertainty of what will happen to the to something which is so sensitive. I say physical bodies are sensitive, and you pinch them and they hurt, and you go out in the heat and they feel hot, and you go out in the cold and they feel cold, and those are all conventions, conventional realities. And but there's also a transcendent reality, a timeless reality, which is recognizing what is beyond birth, old age, sickness, and death. And this is actually what the motivating force of the Buddha himself seeking enlightenment is sort of thing. Why am I, who am subject to old age, sickness, and death, change, impermanence, seek that which is also subject to changing, separation, old age, sickness, and death? Why do I keep doing this? And why don't I look for something that is beyond old age, sickness, and death, beyond change, beyond separation? And that was the theme that was really the doubt in the Buddha's mind, and the motivating impetus to seek that which is seek some form of liberation, some kind of freedom. And in doing that, it's sort of recognizing that these two different aspects of reality. And the Buddha obviously was successful in his search, but did that they stop them from dying? Not really. But what was, well, what was transcendent? That's like, it's like Woody Allen. And, you know, I don't want to achieve immortality through my works. I want to achieve it through not dying. there's this recognition of two different kinds of reality that that we have to understand, we have to deal with, live with, and if we hold to one and disregard the other, then it's just not balanced. It's not in accordance with truth. If we invest all our interest and time and energy in the on the conventional level, we'll be unsatisfied. It's like trying to make ourselves happy through making ourselves comfortable, wealthy, secure, trying to get the physical realm, the conventional realm, down as comfortable as possible. And we all know that doesn't work. The other aspect is sort of trying to say live in a realm of transcendence, like where one doesn't have to deal with the physical body, doesn't have to deal with the realities of things like time and convention. And if one lives like that, they're usually either, you know, psychotic or dysfunctional. It's like it's like not just trying to hold on to a transcendent realm of no change, no coming, no going, no birth, no death, no physical reality. And these are sort of extremes that the mind goes to. And really what the Buddha is always pointing to, a middle way, a balance of how to not be drawn into holding to any form of extreme, whether it's on the physical level, whether it's on the mental level, on the level of our views and opinions, but coming to a point of balance. And this is why the Buddha is always pointing to the Four Noble Truths, the truths of around suffering and cessation of suffering. These are more on an experiential level rather than on a theoretical level of transcendence or convention. What is it that is conducive to happiness and well-being? What is it that's conducive to suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction? Those are the things that the Buddha is saying. This is what's really important. And this is how you are able to sort of weave one's way through the extremes of the conventional world and the transcendent ideals, and be able to live a life of say a practical existence. And certainly the Buddha was extraordinarily practical. Inherit a religious tradition, then you end up with a almost like a mythological figure as the figurehead You look at a Buddha image, and I don't know anybody who's got bumps on their heads like that, you know. You know, I just haven't met anybody like that. And you see, you see the figures, and it's like, there's no bones there, and so everything's all smooth. But it's like an idealized, it is a mythological figure. It's like when at the Wat Nanachat, there was we didn't have a Buddha image on our main shrine. In this new building that we made this lovely new building, and at first I wasn't going to have a Buddha image, because actually in Buddhist history it was many hundreds of years before, about 300 years before they started having Buddha images, and I just wanted to plant a Bodhi tree, and that's what I wanted. Of course, you don't always get what you want. So we had to have a Buddha image. And a person came who was a very skilled sculptor, and said that he would do a Buddha image, and so he started doing it. And he was very skilled, and he was making it was a Buddha about that high in clay, and then we were going to fire it. And I went away he was doing a really lovely job. And then I went away for about a few days or 4 or 5 days. And I came back and he said, oh, I'm really getting close. And then he'd worked on sort of the details of like the arms and the hands and the mudra. And he'd done a really nice job on the face and the general sort of structure. And then, I came and looked, and he said, and he was, as we're walking to the area where he'd been doing, he said, you know, I've been really, you know, thinking about the Buddha image, and you know, sometimes these Buddha images are a bit too sort of stylized and idealized, it should be better to have a more human form. And so I came and took a look at it, and said, you know, well, it is a bit more human, but, you know, I don't think Buddhas should look like hockey players. I mean, it's like, you know, it's really muscles and gnarly hands, you know. So I don't think a Buddha would look like that, even if it is mythological. That is where we take a, it says like a Buddha image, where we do take the idealized form or the mythology. So this sense of trying to get a balance between the convention and the transcendent, the ideal and the practical, and the Buddha is in terms of how. In terms of the teaching, he's pointing to experience. What does it feel like? What's it feel like when we contact the senses? What happens when we say when we hear things? And that's where this is where the teachings of the Buddha are applied. They're what arises in the mind. It's like sitting in meditation, and so you got these birds. Yeah. Is it an obstacle to meditation? Is it a hindrance? Does it disturb meditation? Or is it just a sound? Because there's the sound, and then there's a reaction in the mind. And the actual sound It's just sound. It's us who put the labels on it and label it as pleasant or unpleasant, wanted or unwanted, agreeable or disagreeable. And that it's important to come back to, and that's where we create suffering. That's how we interpret our experience. So that in terms of practice and sort of weaving the way through the conventional and the transcendent, the convention is that we have senses. We experience sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mental objects. The transcendent is not the negation of any sensory experience, but the integration of it and the full understanding of it, and the mind that does not move towards the rejection or acting out of attachment and desire, but is sort of recognizing what we're experiencing. What does it feel like? What's it going towards? What's the result going to be? If the result is going to be towards agitation, confusion, dislike, or attachment, liking, I've got to have it, then the mind has lost its balance. Like, I've got to have those birds to meditate. It's like my meditation is not complete without the birds. We create situations which are really impossible, but it's sort of absurd when you think about it. But that's actually how we run our lives. We set up conditions for ourselves where we're either in a place of lack, where we don't have something and we need to have it, and think if we can't have that, then we'll be happy, or if only this we didn't have that, then my life would be complete. And it's all around a very simple, say, conventional experience of the senses. And this is where learning how to pay attention to our experience. There was once a Western disciple of Ajahn Chah who went to live in one of the branch monasteries of Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah, of course, was a very charismatic teacher. He was my teacher, say Ajahn Sumedho's teacher, Ajahn Amaro's teacher. He was very charismatic, very loving, compassionate, wise, fierce, humorous. He was sort of many things rolled up into one. One wanted to be with him. And of course, he let you come close for a while and then he pushed you away and send you off to branch monasteries, which in the area of Thailand that we lived in, some of those branch monasteries could be quite remote, and they could be quite austere, and sometimes you were with some of the teachers in those monasteries could be not particularly inspiring, and especially if you were comparing them to Ajahn Chah, which is what we did. So this monk had been there for some time, and Ajahn Chah came for a visit, and he was so happy to see Ajahn Chah, and then he had the opportunity to talk with him. He said, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you. I've been practicing here, and it's just really, it's really boring. There's nothing to do. The teacher's not very good. He's not teaching very much. The monks and novices don't seem very diligent in their practice, and I'm really not learning anything. I should go back to Wat Pa Pong. I want to go back with you." And Ajahn Chah said, "What do you mean? This, the teacher isn't, you know, you haven't got a good teacher here." He said, "Well, you know, I just don't see that he's teaching." He said, "You've actually got, it isn't as if you've only got one teacher. You've got six teachers here." I said, "Six teachers?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, and your mind. Those are your teachers. That's what you have to learn from. That's not..." And it's taking it away from the personal and say, learning from your own experience. And this is where, you know, we look at it and either we experience, say, the sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touches and mental objects around us, and we get trapped in the mundane or the conventional and stay on that level and just keep reacting out of our likes and our dislikes and our wants and our not wanting. Or we try to find some idealized form of transcendence, which is divorced from the, say, our sensory experience. And both of those are missing the mark. It's like we've got to be able to really learn from our experience so that we can not be caught in anything which is going to lead to suffering. And this is it's a very direct way of a spiritual path. The Buddha was extraordinarily practical. And one sees that in his teaching. For somebody who, say, established extraordinarily profound philosophical teaching, he was extremely practical, and he would keep and he was also, the teachings that he gave were often about the things that were happening around all the time, things that he just paying attention, like, to nature around, paying attention to the changing seasons, paying attention to the habits of animals, or paying attention to things which certainly, it's like the Buddha, even though he was highly educated and led a privileged life, one of the similes that really sticks in my mind, and it says the Buddha used similes, which things that he was observing and watching, paying attention to what was happening around him. I was like, he's using the simile of a tool, an adze, like an axe handle or an adze handle, and saying that, you know, in the same way the spiritual path is gradual, and there isn't one point where you can sort of say, this is where I got rid of that defilement and that's where I got rid of those defilements. So it's a gradual wearing away, in the same way as the workman who uses an axe every day or an adze every day. But over time, you see the marks on the handle, and you see the tool has been worn in, and the Buddha didn't come up that simile because he was out chopping wood or anything very much, I wouldn't think. It's like really being observant to the things around him. And I think that for ourselves, this is a very wonderful example of, you know, learning, paying attention to the things that happen around us, whether it's people, events, our how we interact with the world, how we engage with the world, how we pay attention to the world. So that the Buddha is pointing to this sensory experience and encouraging us to use this as the foundation for our spiritual practice. It's not about trying to attain some extraordinary abstruse meditative state where you don't come into contact with the world around you. That's like the extreme of the transcendent ideal. But how do we engage with the world, our senses, our own mind, our heart, without creating suffering? And there's in Buddhist terminology, we're using, and the Buddha uses the tool of suffering as a basis for investigation. And but it's interesting to reflect again in terms of, you're talking about balance and weaving between two sort of extremes, like the conventional and the transcendent, and what the Buddha is pointing to, if using suffering as an investigation, but what he's advising in terms of practicing or putting into practice in one's daily life are the things which create happiness. So it's like it's a path of creating happiness and using the tool of suffering for investigation. So it's like trying to develop this balance again, weaving one's way through. Because normally what happens is we tend to we go towards happiness and pleasure and comfort, and we hold on to it, and we reject suffering, try to avoid it at all costs, and don't really use it as a tool for investigation. But if you're reflecting, like when the Buddha encourages us to keep precepts, you know, what's the point of that? Well, it's actually establishing a foundation of happiness and well-being, because one's living a life of non-harming or not creating confusion in one's life, and creating bonds of trust with one's fellow human beings. So it's laying a foundation of happiness. The developing of qualities of generosity, the quality of giving, of sharing, of generosity, and creates tremendous happiness in the heart. The heart that is able to share, to give, to openly help others because of a generosity of heart. The foundation is really a quality of happiness. And it creates happiness. And it puts one into contact with other human beings in a way which generates more happiness. encouragement to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. These are qualities which just bring up a tremendous amount of well-being in the heart. And the Buddha is quite adamant in terms of say loving kindness is the appropriate response to in one's engagement with others, even if one's being set upon by. I mean, he gives this classic image of even if you're set upon by thieves and they cut you limb by limb with a two-handled saw, if you stray from sort of thoughts of loving kindness, then you're not following the teachings. That's a tough practice. Yeah. So when the heart is established in loving kindness, now what's the result? The mind is extraordinarily bright and happy. So the path that the Buddha lays out is really a path of happiness. But the investigation is around of suffering. There's these two aspects, two realities that we take into consciousness and try to investigate and try to understand what's the dynamic, how do they work, how do we weave our way through things so that we're not stuck. Because usually what happens is we hold to one extreme or another. The extreme of holding on to happiness. And if we do that, if we hold on to happiness, then we'll really start to see suffering. Because when it ends, it can be quite painful. It's like in Buddhist cosmology or mythology, they said the beings who suffer the most are the devatas. Because when they start to lose their luster, and they realize they're actually going to die, pass away from that realm, that tremendous grief that comes up. But because they've been experiencing so much happiness. Or also this where the Buddha, from a Buddhist, say, cosmological perspective, the human realm is the ideal realm for liberation, because we do experience both happiness and suffering. The divine realms are not optimum, because one experiences too much pleasure. Okay. One's distracted all the time. It's like in the first sermon that the Buddha gives. He's struggled with his years of asceticism. He's practiced the path. He's realized truth, and he tries to think who's going to understand this. And finally, he goes to teach the five ascetics who lived and practiced with him. And after teaching them, and his first teaching was Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, and one of the recluses understands Kundalini. The Buddha sort of exclaims, Kundalini understands, he's got his first disciple, he's understood. And in the discourse, and it's sort of like the lower, the Buddha exclaims, oh, Kundalini understands, and so he's entered the path. And then the sort of the celestial beings rejoice. First the sort of the earth devas, and then the next level of devas, they pass on the word. And Kandanya has understood the Buddha sort of there's a Buddha has arisen in the world, he's teaching, and the sort of the joy, the rejoicing, cries of rejoicing spread through the heaven realms. But they all go home. I mean, none of them, they don't understand. It's only Kandanya. It's like wonderful. You know, back to my sipping my tea. Or go out and smell my flowers. You know, whatever. So that the ability to take the experience of happiness, the experience of suffering, and to use it as tools for investigation. I think that's what is really what they say is the underlying theme that is allows us to sort of weave our way through the extremes, is that rather than say happiness and suffering or conventional reality, transcendent realities being objects to be believed in, they're objects for investigation, they're objects to be understood. And that is what allows us to not get lost. So whether we, in our, because it all started with birthdays, 50 years old. You know, whether we're 50 years old or 25 years old or 80 years old, whether we're young and vigorous, whether we're experiencing sickness and difficulty, these are all things to be investigated. Whether we're experiencing what we agree with, what is agreeable to us or disagreeable, whether it's something which is pleasant or unpleasant on an emotional tone, it's something to be investigated, and so that we can see what is it that will allow us to experience the qualities of clarity, of peace, to be established in the, say, spiritual qualities, spiritual powers of effort, of stability of mind, of confidence, of investigative, say, discernment, wisdom. So those are the, it's like the, these are all, they're all tools. Nothing is an end in itself. And it's just letting go, and it's this is what sort of allows us to let go. Because nothing can be really held on to, whether it's our own sense of identity of ourselves or the nature of the world, the universe. And it's all to be relinquished. It's all to be let go of. And this is where Ajahn Chah says, very succinctly, if you let go a little, you'll get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you get complete peace. So I'll offer that for your reflection this evening. Anybody has any questions? I may or may not have an answer.
I'm wondering about the quality of the phrasing of accumulating these experiences. So that it isn't really just plain thinking.
Yeah, I mean it's really not if it's on the level of just sort of thinking and the sort of rational assessment and you know, intellectual analysis, it doesn't really reach the heart. And this it's interesting in Buddhist ways of description, there's not a distinction between the sort of the, say, the brain and the heart, and the thinking and the emotional qualities. There's just one word, citta. And for ties as well. If you ask ties, where's your mind? And they'll go here. And in ancient Indian sort of medical texts, they had quite detailed descriptions of mental processes and thinking and emotional states, but it was all associated with the heart base, and they weren't really quite sure what was up here. They thought it was more like a place where, you know, like mucus was stored or something. Every once in a while it'd run out, you know. So certainly in the Western culture, we've definitely overemphasized the thinking, the rational mind, and which isn't to try to just shut it off either. Like many times people will come to me and complain that I can't meditate because I can't stop thinking. And I mean, those are two different statements. They're because it isn't as if, say, that meditating is trying to just stop the thinking, because it will. It's like damming a stream, but not having a spillway. Some way where, for instance, you build a dam, but don't have any overflow to it, and then it'll hold the water back for a while, and then the dam will burst. So oftentimes, people will put tremendous amount of effort in trying to stop their thinking, and it doesn't actually make. Well, even if you are able to stop thinking, it doesn't necessarily make you very peaceful. Usually, it makes you quite tense, agitated, actually. So that being able to understand the thinking, being able to have a context for the thinking, and then being able to let go of the thinking, because thoughts will come up. And this is where the say like the word that's usually used for meditation, one of the words that's used for meditation in Buddhism, almost invariably it's translated as concentration, and that has a certain connotation to it. To establish the mind firmly, to have a settled feeling, to have a stable foundation of the mind. It doesn't mean there's no thinking, but there's a firmness there that's able to recognize what's going on. It's not shaken by the thought process. Whereas concentration just seems there's so much sort of force involved of trying to hold back the thought processes. And it's all about awareness. It's all about mindfulness. It's being able to be mindful, to be aware. It's how we direct attention is what is sort of the key. So being able to even to direct attention to thoughts and not get engaged in the personal identification with my thoughts. I'm right, they're wrong. It's got to be like this. But this is a thought. Or the attention that is directed on the arising and passing away of things, arising and passing away of thoughts, arising and passing away of feelings, arising and passing away of the breath. This is a very peaceful meditation to actually stay with, like the, because usually again, sort of the meditation. Often we try to concentrate the mind on the breath and just try to hold the mind on the breath. Like just to just take awareness and attention and have a feel for the breath arising, in breath coming in the feeling, and the breath passing away, or a thought arising, a thought passing away, without sort of adding anything to it. Or similarly, like we were talking about sounds, just to allow a sound to come in, and just let it be a sound rather than I like it, I don't like it, this is an obstruction, that. Oh, that's really pleasant. Wow, that's really nice. Or tripping off memories. The memories that are come up. And then one goes into, we can go into whole scenarios from the past. Yeah. But it's like the, when Ajahn Chah first went to England, he was, was offered was already an established small monastery city in the city of London. It was a house, and it was in the middle of London, nice suburb, but it was on a big thoroughfare, a big street, and then right across from a pub. So that meditations in the summertime, windows open, Friday night, Saturday night, pub across the way. Very interesting. Not sort of idyllic park type sensory experience. And then people asking after the meditation, how do you meditate when sounds come to bother you? And Ajahn Chah said, You're looking at it the wrong way. It's like the sounds aren't coming to bother you. You're going out and bothering the sounds. When the sounds are just sounds, you're going... You're getting involved in it. You're going out and making a problem out of it. So that's... I mean, we do that with all our sensory experience. Our thoughts. Our feelings. This is right. It shouldn't be this way. How could that person do that? Life's purpose. Yeah, right, yeah. Well, again, from a Buddhist perspective, the purpose is to be free from suffering. Very simple. Because it's measurable. And it's not idealistic. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of inspiring ideals. But it's usually what we think up above, and invest a tremendous amount of self-image in. But on a very fundamental level, how do we live in a way where we suffer less and are happy more? That starts to expand into both in a very practical way, and again, bridging the conventional reality to the transcendent, because it's just. And I said, like the Buddha, why do I, when subject to old age, sickness, and death, keep going towards an accumulator and spending my time with that which is also subject to those things? So then, seeking that which is truly peaceful, which is truly benevolent, which is truly compassionate, which is truly harmonious. So on a personal level, it has one is creating a quality of well-being on one's interaction with the world on a social level, then it can't help but create those qualities with around one, so that it is, I think that's one of the things that is, to me, always been very inspiring about the Buddhist teachings. Is you take a small part of the teachings and you start extrapolating, expanding it, and start seeing how it applies. And it has these very practical applications on a very mundane level, on individual level, and expands out into the social or to the cosmological. It applies. These same principles apply. So whether it's in both the analysis of things, just on a simple level, everything's impermanent. It's like, taking that as an investigation. The implications carry through everything. And then on the level of application of the teachings and the benefits that come from that. So it's best to keep it simple. You start expanding it out too much and you get lost. You come back to how can I take this moment and be as clear as possible, and say suffer less, and establish myself a well-being more. It's a very practical tool. It's something that, because my name actually means one with faith. Pasanno means one with faith. So it's been a theme for reflection over the years. And on a conventional level, it's faith that motivates us to put things in action. And in the Buddha's teaching, and Buddha always gives lists of things, and sort of list of spiritual powers or spiritual faculties. Faith is the first faculty. And it's your initial faculty. And the second one is effort. So it's like faith leads to effort. If faith isn't leading to effort, then it's not functioning. If there's faith without putting it into action, then it's not working. So that faith is really and faith. It's also maybe it's good to also define faith as well in terms of from a Buddhist perspective. I say maybe the word confidence is a bit better. Faith is we have sort of residues of our language which has connotations that sometimes are not so appealing. And also in that perspective of spiritual faculties, there's faith, energy, mindfulness, the word that's translated as concentration, and wisdom. And there, so you've got a linear progression, but then you've also got the dynamic of how they work within each other. So like, and it's all, and traditionally it's always paired. Faith and wisdom are your pair, and energy and concentration, which is like energy and peacefulness, peace of mind, are the pair that work together. So the dynamic between the two is what's going to lead to spiritual growth. Faith and wisdom, or investigation and confidence, and then also say the energy and peace. And then your middle one, your balancing factor, is always the mindfulness, awareness. That's always there's a discourse where the Buddhist sort of says you can never have too much mindfulness. It's a faculty which always is that's your balancing faculty. And faith is also as one continues to practice, it seems that Buddhism puts a tremendous effort on, say, wisdom, and it seems to be quite a, heady, intellectual, rational system of philosophical thought. But as one continues to practice, one starts to realize that actually wisdom isn't able to let go. Faith is what lets go. It isn't. Wisdom gives you the kind of confidence to sort of, okay, I can let go, I've got it, I can take it this far, or it seems right. But it's the quality of faith that is actually able to let go. And so faith is you know, as a spiritual faculty, is extraordinarily essential. Oftentimes it's sort of kind of seen as the poor cousin to wisdom. But in reality, the dynamic that it creates, because without faith in something, we don't ever put it into practice. And so that nurturing faith is a very important part of practice. How do we sustain faith in a way that's balanced and beneficial? How do we nurture the quality of heart that is willing to sort of leap forward and rather than sort of moan and complain and try to look for easy ways or whatever. And it's like, faith is what goes and does something. If it's wisdom, try to figure out, give me a break. also, it's interesting to say traditionally, what is it that supports faith? And traditionally, what is the basis of faith? Is the confidence in the enlightenment of the Buddha, that one recognizes or feels, or there one starts to get a feel that yes, the Buddha was an enlightened being, and that enlightenment is possible in the human condition. Because this is, the Buddha was not some sort of God, he was a human being, and he laid out a path for others to experience liberation, freedom, enlightenment. So that if the Buddha's enlightenment is real and true, it means that it's possible for everybody. And if one has that confidence, that's what faith is. The Buddha's, the enlightenment of the Buddha is a real and true thing, and that is possible for me also. Right. Oh, okay. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So it's like, if one goes in a linear way, then it says, faith is leading to wisdom, and wisdom is the goal. But then, the way it's always interpreted really is Well, one, it's all, I mean, they're usually sort of circles. So that faith, sort of going through the progression to wisdom, but then wisdom sort of circling around and supporting faith, and then feeding that circle. But then also then it sort of feeding in on each other as well, and sort of faith and wisdom balancing each other, and the energy and stability of mind balancing each other, and mindfulness keeping track of it all. I mean, these are teaching tools as well, so you can interpret things in different ways. Okay, lovely to see you all again. I had a great 50th birthday. I really did, yeah. That was wonderful. I came out and had the meal down in McCarricker Park, on the beach, various people from the coast here and over in the monastery came, went for a walk, tide pools. I grew up inland in Canada, never saw the sea, spent all my time in Thailand inland, never saw the sea. First time I saw a tide pool was when I first arrived, and they took me up to the Sinkyo. Yeah. So it's kind of neat.